Marcus Capone.
How you doing? Good to be here.
Thank you so much for being on. I appreciate it. It's funny how we connected. I met your son at his job, and he was like, "Oh, you have a podcast? Like, you should interview my dad." I'm like, "All right, let's do it."
So, yeah, that was cool. When he sent me a note, I was like, "Yeah, what's going on here?" But he meets so many cool people at the Hotel Del.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, he works there, he hustles, and he's always like, "Hey, I saw so and so today." I said, "Oh, that's pretty cool."
Yeah.
So I told him, you know, he makes really good money there, and I said, until you figure out, you know, what's next, like, you got to keep that job.
It's a great spot to be.
Yeah. I mean, I told him, you know, a big night for me back in college, if I was waiting tables or something, like a huge night was $100 and like, yeah. I was rich.
Yeah.
And he'll come home with like $1,000.
Oh, I bet.
You know, or the weekend, you know, 1500, 2K, 2500.
Yep.
I'm just going, wow.
Well, you think about it, the average night there is like, I think it's like $1,500 a night, sometimes even more, you know?
Yeah, it's great. And he drives every single high-end car that you can imagine.
Yeah.
Which,
yeah.
I don't know, is a little dangerous in my opinion, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's not going very far, so that's good.
No.
Cool.
No, he's not.
So for the audience that doesn't know you, why don't you tell them a little bit about who you are, what your background is, and what you're doing now?
Yeah. Wow. I could do that probably for a couple hours, but yeah, Marcus Capone, you know, I grew up in New York, in Long Island, New York, the Catholic school. Ended up in the Midwest on a football scholarship. I was a quarterback at Southern Illinois University. And then I married the coach's daughter and graduated and enlisted in the Navy. And I spent the next 13 years as a Navy SEAL. And I was actually medically retired in 2013 and then stepped off in the private sector, went to graduate school at USC, and it's kind of hopped around, private banking. I started a few companies, and then I ended up in mental health care through my own struggles and challenges. And for me, what I found was life-changing. It was life-saving, and I wanted to pay it forward, really. And that was in 2017. And, you know, fast forward, my wife and I, Amber, who founded VETS, is the nonprofit with me, Veterans Exploring Treatment Solutions. So we started that in 2018. We've built that now for 6 years. We're going to, we'll hit veteran number 1,000 here in the next couple months that we have funded for treatment. And that sparked a whole lot of things that are going on in our lives. One of them being my, my day-to-day, which is TAR Mind. What we've learned at VETS, we've taken to the employee benefit space, and we're selling novel therapeutics to self-funded employers. And so what we're doing in healthcare, we believe we're revolutionizing the future of mental health care, offering up a solution that should be covered under your benefit plans.
Yeah. And the solution is?
Well, the solution is, you know, we're careful how we talk about this, but it's psychedelic therapy, and we call it psychedelic assisted therapy, meaning, you know, the drug itself is the psychedelic, and when we pair that with the proper preparation and integration therapy, we're seeing that the results are so much more compounded than just using the drug alone. And so, you know, right now, what I initially was introduced to was a drug called Ibogaine. Comes from a shrub called the iboga plant, iboga root, iboga shrub. It's grown in West Africa, and the actual it's actually the root at the bottom, the root bark. So they like grind it down. It's like this kind of wood, nasty, chalky material. And there's about 13. I believe there's 13 alkaloids in there, and the one that's most prevalent is ibogaine.
Right.
And so they kind of synthesize ibogaine out of that, out of the full plant, if you want to call it the full root.
Right.
And that's the, you know, drug that I was introduced to outside the U.S. In Mexico, where it is legal, or say unregulated.
Yeah.
And for me, that experience was like literally so life shifting. I really just wanted to pay it forward. And
right.
It was at the time when, I want to say many, but there actually were many of my friends were starting to struggle with mental health issues.
Right.
I don't want to call it mental health, but everybody was struggling with something at that time. And it was at that time where a lot of our folks were going to brain clinics. They were doing everything. And many were not getting better. And so for me, something that almost healed me overnight you know, I was trying to find the solution for 7 years, right? And so when I got introduced initially to traditional mental health approaches, I was prescribed antidepressants and talk therapy. I was on them for 7 years and, you know, a multitude of them. I was at one point, I was on 10 different prescription medications and they weren't working and I was getting worse. And so when you find something that works, you kind of want to scream from the rooftops and say, hey, like everybody needs to know about this. And that's how we felt. But I also felt that there was a lot of risk there because I was still like kind of in the grind of what I was doing and work. And I was almost scared that this was going to be frowned upon or looked upon different and weird. And Michael Pollan's book hadn't come out yet, How to Change Your Mind. And so the public was still not fully aware of psychedelics being a real solution for mental health. But about a year in, one of our very dear friends, she lost her husband. Her husband died by suicide. And we just thought, you know, we got to do something about this. We don't want to let this happen to any more of our friends. And we have to come out and start talking about it. And so, ironically, I think soon after that, we did, an interview in Time Magazine. And I was scared to death because I was really worried about what people were going to think about this. But we had to do it. I felt like it was the more we can talk about this, the more individuals are going to learn that there's hope out there. There's stuff that works other than what potentially they were currently going through in terms of treatment.
Right.
And that's all that mattered. And then, you know, fast forward to today, now I feel like it's way above Amber and I. And this is not about us. This is about, and it makes it easier to talk about it. So when I talk, I feel like it's for everybody else. And I take me out of the equation, and then I don't have to worry about what people think.
Yeah, that's good. So, well, yeah. I think that there's a big, when you get out of the military, especially doing something high speed like what you did, I mean, you weren't just a SEAL. Like you were, you were SEAL Team 10 and then also development group, right?
So, yeah. And people don't know, it's SEAL Team 6. You know, for many years, of course, I was also scared to talk about that. But everywhere I turn these days, there's guys I worked with. I spent 13 years. There's guys I served with that are coming out at 30 years that are talking about it. So I figured, you know, if those individuals can talk about this, then I can say a few things about it too. So,
yeah,
you know, because we try to keep as much as we can, in secret behind closed doors. But I think it's important for us to get a lot of these stories out. You know, people want to hear them. And also it's, you know, young kids, you know, look up to soldiers and they want to be like them when they get older. And so we do need to tell these stories. I think it's important.
Yeah. And when you get out of the military, you know, there's a big gap where people go, they get out of the military, they think everything's going to be, okay, now everything's going to get easy. And that's really when it gets hard, right? Yeah. I know that that's a big piece of your story is you got out and you felt like...
Yeah, my wife thought, oh, this is going to be Amber. You know, she thought, oh, this is going to be great. We're going to be one big fat bee family. And it was like the complete opposite. The transition is really tough. For some, it's relatively easy. For many, it's extremely difficult. You know, I think you lose that safety net, you lose your tribe, your community, you know, the individuals that you leaned on every day. You're barely home. I mean, for us, we were home 60 days a year. We were on the road, you know, 300 days a year between training and deployments and everything else. And so you're with your buddies more than anything. And that's your, you know, that becomes your family. And then when you leave that, now what?
Right.
So do you have to find a new family and your family you haven't spent a whole lot of time with. So now you're trying to get to know your wife and your children almost for like the first time. So this is all, and then this all happens at once. So you're stepping off and you may be putting on a suit and tie and going to work and then trying to take care of a family that you don't even know too well. You may be bringing some baggage with it, whether it's PTSD or traumatic brain injury or whatever. And so now you put all that together, it's like a recipe for a disaster. Like it's a perfect storm, right? And so there's a lot there. And, you know, just antidepressants aren't going to solve that problem, right?
Yeah.
And so we got to do other things that are unconventional. And then we've taken an unconventional approach to this, I'd call this mental health crisis that, you know, not just veterans are going through, even though there's a higher rate, But the U.S. is you know, over 25% clinically diagnosed with depression.
Yeah.
The world, the same thing. And so what are we doing and how are we fixing it?
Yeah. And the thing is, in with guys that come out of the military, a lot of the times they've dealt with undiagnosed traumatic brain injuries. But also, when you look at PTSD and the symptoms, TBI and PTSD are kind of similar when it comes to symptoms.
They're completely overlapping.
Yeah.
You know, and when you go visit a primary care physician, your PCP, they're not equipped. I mean, they're not a neurologist. They're not a psychiatrist. They're not a therapist. But they're prescribing you antidepressants, right? So PCPs prescribe 80% of all prescriptions in the U.S., but they're really not equipped to deal with a person that's got overlapping TBI and PTSD or depression or, you know, whatever you're coming in with. So it's not a great system the way it's set up to help individuals that have these issues. And so that's why you're hearing that so many people are struggling. And I know, you know, we're always trying to fix the system, but it sometimes takes a while.
Yeah. So going back a little bit, so how did you grow up? What was your childhood like?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, you know, I grew up just really, I was like jock. Like all I did was play ball. I played anything that I could. My parents kept me extremely busy. I mean, I swam, played soccer, I played baseball, I played football. I was a lifeguard. I was on skis at three. I was in the water at three or four. Played lacrosse. You know, if you're from Long Island, you have to play lacrosse a little bit, right? But I wound up playing baseball after that. So I was an athlete. My parents, I joke, were, you know, looking back, and I didn't even know at the time, but like they were hippies. You know, both my parents went to Woodstock, and my mom would put on her bandana and go protest the Vietnam War downtown in Manhattan. And I remember, you know, coming home from my senior year of college and telling them I wanted to be a SEAL, and they kind of both looked at each other and they were like, "What?" They had, you know, I didn't really grow up in this like uber patriotic home.
Sure.
Even though my grandfather fought in Northern Africa in World War II.
Sure.
He actually earned a Purple Heart. And I used to see this Purple Heart in the house, but I never understood it.
Right.
Like it was there, but I never really knew really what it meant, like truthfully, like what it meant. And so, you know, my parents just thought it was crazy that I wanted to graduate and go in the military. But for me, I was like searching for something more.
Yeah.
You know, going back to the childhood question, there was, you know, I experienced a lot of, I don't want to say, but like I had to perform to be accepted, right? It was like always like you had to win, you had to get good grades. I had to, you know, everything I had to do was to be accepted by my mom and dad. And, you know, if I threw four touchdown passes and threw an interception, all I'd hear about is the interception.
Mm.
Or like I used to get straight A's, but I always remembered I always got a C in like handwriting or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was always like I got yelled at for the handwriting.
Right.
You know, so I always had this weird, you know, obviously that stuck with me forever. And, you know, of course there was, you know, physical and emotional that, you know, came with that and a lot of it. And so, you know, when I, my senior year of high school, I got injured the beginning of my senior year. I couldn't play football that year, and I had torn two ligaments.
Senior of
high school.
High school, okay.
I tore two ligaments, and so I couldn't play football. And so what I did was I rehabbed as much as I could, and it almost took, I was in a cast for 6 months. I actually swam with a waterproof cast my senior year. I actually made the cities that year. And did pretty good with a cast on. But I was able to get the cast off and play my senior year of baseball. But because of that, I wanted to play football in college. I wasn't getting any offers because I didn't play my senior year. And so what I did is I went to junior college, which was Nassau Community, which was one of the top football junior colleges in the country at the time. And, I mean, when I showed up there, it was like, holy shit, it was the men.
Yeah.
I mean, the offense and defensive line was like, you know, 6'5", 6'7", across the board, you know, 315.
My dad played football at Fresno State, and he went there. He got hurt like right away, but he was like, yeah, this, I'm good. Like, this is just a different level that I don't want to play
at. It was unbelievable. I mean, everybody, you know, all the D-backs and wide receivers ran, you know, 4.5, 4.4 40s. And so for me, it just elevated me to that level.
Yeah.
And so I really enjoyed playing with those folks. And then my first year there, I redshirted. There was just phenomenal athletes. Literally every year we had over 20 individuals go play Division I at all the big schools.
Yeah.
And, you know, my second year I got to actually play and played well, and I was offered a full scholarship to Southern Illinois University, and that's where I ended up.
Wow.
So
really cool. So when you were growing up, I know you said you had this Purple Heart like in the house, but did you always sort of think that you wanted to be in the military, or was your goal
never
NFL?
Never. Yeah, my goal was NFL.
Yeah. That's because when you're playing college football, it's like you didn't go right into the military. Right. So it was something that.
Right. No, I had no desire to go in the military. Matter of fact, I remember being at Southern Illinois University and walking into the it's like the area where everyone, like all the students would hang out, and there's, you know, food and you did work there and stuff. And there was always recruiters, military recruiters.
Yeah.
And they would always, like, you walk by them and they would always kind of call you over. And I always remember just going like, no, not for me. You know, not for me.
Yeah.
And walking by them. And yeah, it's funny how things work out.
Yeah.
But yeah, never grew up thinking I was going to go spend 13 years on active duty for sure.
Yeah, it's funny how life sort of evolves, and in every phase of life you can look back and be like, well, I didn't see that coming, no matter what it is, you know?
Yeah.
So you go into the military, and so you went into the Navy, and did you get a SEAL contract, or how did you?
I actually did. And, you know, looking back, I don't really know how it was structured, but back then they didn't rank the individuals, I believe, how they do now. So like now you want to go to BUDS and be a SEAL. Each region, you know, it's way more advanced. I mean, they have a whole recruiting teams that are just SEALs.
Yeah.
And they're going out all across the country, and they're working individuals out, and they're testing them. You actually get ranked now.
Yeah.
So if you're in a region, like let's say like Boston, there might be like, you know, 250 individuals that want to go to BUDS. Each time though, they may take, I don't know, I'm making this up, 25.
Yeah.
So if you're 26, you're not going.
Yeah.
Right? You'll be first next time. But if like you're 225, it's going to be a long time before you even get accepted into the program.
Crazy. Yeah.
For me, I don't know, is maybe because I was coming out of college. It was a funny story. I went down the recruiter. I didn't even know the difference between an officer and an enlisted guy. Like I had zero military background or you know, mentorship.
Yeah.
And the recruiter goes, well, you're Marcus at the Capone at the university, right? And blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah. He goes, well, you're graduating, right? And I said, yeah, of course. And he goes, well, you can be an officer. I was like, great, what's that? And he explained it to me, and he goes, well, you know, X, Y, and Z. He goes, I have to hand you off to the recruiting station in St. Louis because they handle all officer kind of billets. And so I went up to St. Louis and I applied in like all the officer programs, you know, took the tests and did all that. And I got picked up for every program except Special Warfare.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, Special Warfare had such a, you know, very competitive programming. And so for me, I wasn't going in the military to just go in the military. I wanted to be a SEAL. And so I told the recruiter, I said, you know, this is great. I can go be a nuke. I can go on a ship. I can go do all these other things, but I want to be a SEAL. He said, well, you can go back and you can enlist, and then, you know, down the road, you can go to, you know, officer candidate school or, you know, warrant officer or whatever. And again, these words meant nothing to me at the time.
Yeah.
Right. And so all I heard was you can go enlisted and be a SEAL. I said, great. Like, sign me up.
Nice. So you had your target set. I mean, you knew exactly what you wanted.
I knew exactly what I wanted to do. You know, to your question earlier, I did get a billet, a SEAL billet. So I was, I guess in my contract, like I was going to BUDS.
Sure.
As long as I passed my screening.
Yeah.
And in boot camp, I remember you woke up extra early. I believe it was like 3 a.m. to be at the pool at 4 a.m. to work out before your boot camp class got up.
Yeah.
And I think the first day there was, I don't know, maybe like 30 something guys that woke up and did that. By the end, I was the only guy left that was still going to do the workouts in the morning.
Yeah.
So
wow.
I think they really cut the fat really quickly there.
Yeah. I bet it's pretty easy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, easy is that nothing was ever easy. I mean, it was always hard work, and I think it's always how hard.
I mean,
push
easy
it.
To tell if somebody's not.
Oh, 100%.
I feel like you can
that part. Yeah, yeah. You weed people out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
When it's funny, Goggins is a friend, and we were at he was a class ahead of me at Buds, but I like a lot of things he does. One of the things he says is motivation only lasts like a certain amount of time. It's got like a shelf life.
Yeah.
But discipline.
Yeah.
Is the thing that keeps you going. And that's what it is. Like everyone shows up on day one.
Yeah.
And they're like, yo, yeah, I'm going to be this and that and the other. But then tomorrow you have to wake up at 3 and the next day. And oh, by the way, the next 8 weeks you have to wake up at 3 and go do the same thing. You definitely lose motivation. You're tired. You don't want to be there. But the discipline of you getting up every day and going to do that is few and far between.
So you had mentioned something about when you were growing up, you had a lot of criticism towards you would do something right, but it was always the spotlight was on something negative. So when you're going through this, when you're trying, I mean, no matter what you were going to do, let's say you got hurt in Buds and that wasn't able to work out. You, no matter what, you were going to do something exceptional. I know that for a fact, right? Was that driven by that wanting to prove something to your family or whoever, right? Because when you're growing up, you have that negative spotlight that ingrains something in you that's lifelong.
I always had to prove something. Like I felt like I was constantly in this state of proving and showing people I can do this, showing, you know, whether I'm sure, you know, at the end of the day, it's yourself,
yeah,
right? You don't realize that because how the world looks at you is not how you look at you.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure the world was like, oh, he's great.
Right.
I want to be like that individual. You look at yourself a lot of times like you're a failure.
Yeah.
And when I look back, I always felt like I've failed things versus I excelled at things. And that was, you know, like I said, beaten into me at a very young age. And so I viewed life as constant failures, mm-hmm. and that you have to, you know, and that is, it also drives you, right? And so, but there's a fine line there. Because there's plenty of people that also succeed and do well that didn't grow up thinking that everything they did was a failure or being, you know, everything that they did wrong was pointed out,
right,
and like hammered because you build these neural pathways thinking like you're a failure, right?
So that drove you, right?
It definitely drove me for sure. I never thought about it, why or what.
Yeah.
It was obviously a driver subconsciously to always win, to always succeed, to always never fail. Failing was losing. Losing was bad. You know, losing, losers, not winning. So everything I had to do, you know, competing was everything.
Right.
You know, and I still have competitive nature, even though I'm not obsessive about it. But inside, like, I want to win.
Yeah, yeah. I'm fascinated by what makes people tick. You know, like, what are the things that happen to us when we're young that make us make certain decisions, especially when you see behaviors that are repetitive? It's like that always, in myself, like, I'm always trying to see this stuff. And like you said, like, we don't, especially in the moment, we don't see these things. But I'm always trying to go through my childhood and, like, see the things that formed me and try to figure out, like, why do I do certain things the way I do things now, whether it's something well or something not? But
do you do that now or did you always do that?
I don't know when I started doing that. I think because I got sober in 2016, so 8 years ago, I think that took a lot of the filters away and forced me to put myself under the microscope and not suppress a lot of certain things, you know, and really like be honest with myself.
Yeah, be okay with understanding.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I've always been curious about things like that, but I don't think I ever, like, I wasn't intentional about it. You know what I mean?
I never thought about it until, I'd say, recent times. And when I say recent times, I always go back from 2017, you know, when I had my first, I began experience, my kind of waking up to now. And, you know, a lot has happened in between there. You know, there's definitely been dips, but it's always, I feel like, that has started this growth spurt, and this new growth spurt that every day, you know, continue to learn, continue to be aware.
Yeah.
Aware of what we're talking about now. Looking back and going, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
Like now I get why I am the way I am. the failure thing, I remember talking to Amber about it, my wife, and saying, you know what? I look back on every phase of my life as a failure point.
Mm-hmm.
Like literally every single phase, I go right to, oh, wait, I failed at that.
Yeah.
I failed at that. I failed at that. I failed at, like, it's crazy. And I actually looked at it like that.
Yeah.
Until I woke up and said, oh, well, there are some things that were, you did pretty well too.
Yeah. So when you're going through buds and you're watching people ring that bell, you're like, that's never going to fucking be me, I bet.
Yeah. I never looked at buds as a, if I have to pass fail this.
Yeah.
I always looked at it as, oh, this is a school I have to go to be a SEAL.
Yeah.
And that's how I looked at it from day one. So I never thought I was going to quit. I thought maybe I wouldn't be able to do like physical exercises. And that was only because I, you know, I did push-ups and sit-ups and pull-ups, and you can't do those forever, right?
Yeah.
Like you stop.
Yeah.
And you keep hearing the stories of, yeah, but you did it, you have to do it for 6 months, you know, I always question, I'm like, well, like when you can't do any more push-ups, like what do you do then? You know, so yeah, I had these weird things of, I had no idea what you do. Then I realized, like, you know, you stick your ass in the air, you put your knees on the ground when the instructors aren't looking, like
yeah.
You figure it out. But before that, that was the only thing I said, okay, when I can't do these exercises anymore, like what happens then? So that was like the unknown, but I never thought I was going to quit.
Yeah.
I never said like, oh, I'm going to just get up and say I'm done.
Yeah. So like the thing that it's just, and sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but the thing that really fascinates me is the mindset. Like you were saying when we were talking earlier on how some people, they're focused on why they can't do it. Quitting wasn't even an option for you.
It was never an option.
Yeah.
It was never an option. And what I was surprised about or not when I got there, there were some really talented individuals. We started with 175 dudes. And I remember looking around, some of these guys were, like you said, like Olympic athletes.
Yeah.
I remember seeing a guy stretch, like, you know, he could do like the splits. And I'm just like, dude, I can barely touch my toes. And I, you know, seeing guys literally do 50 pull-ups. And I was just blown away. I kept saying, like, these guys are in shape.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I was in shape. And I was a bigger guy, which was funny because some of the guys made jokes about that. And I would tell them, I was like, guys, I'm a 6'4", 225-pound quarterback. The guys I played with were really big.
Yeah.
Really big. But anyway, it was... I never thought about quitting. I saw a lot of ego there. There was a lot of individuals that talked a great game.
Yeah.
Something I never did. That was also something that I'm not struggling. I've always been a humble individual. I'm trying to get better at being, if you want to call it, confident.
Yeah.
And less self-deprecating.
Sure.
Which I've always been good at. But there was really, you know, everybody there thought they were the shit and they were the best. And yeah, many of those individuals went away.
Right. Well, like you were saying, the people that did well in buds were the ones that were the workhorses. They kept their head down.
It was the gray man. You know, I couldn't, unfortunately, be a gray man at 6'4", but but that's okay. You know, again, I was humble. I never talked back. You know, yeah. I was a good soldier. The gray man is always, you know, they always try to tell you, you turn around at the end of buds and you're like, hey, who's that guy? He's like, never said a word. He somehow just kind of made it through.
Yeah. Blended in.
Yeah.
That's funny. So when you went into buds, what was the hardest thing for you?
I always tell everybody waking up every day, honestly, because the individual evolutions are what they are. You know, you carry a boat, carry a log, run 4 miles, swim 5.5 miles or that stuff was just, to me, PT.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it sucked, but you were sucking with a group, right?
Yeah.
And you know, a joke, misery loves company. That's like a funny saying.
Yeah.
It's true. But when you're miserable with your buddies, like, it's great. Cause you can, you know, you laugh about it while you're getting your head beat in. So the hardest part of buds is literally waking up every day because you are so sore. Think of the hardest workout you've ever done, CrossFit or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, you feel like you got rhabdo, right? And you're just so sore. And the next day you go, I'm not working out because I'm sore. Okay. So you're like that at buds every day times like 1,000. So you wake up in the morning after the worst squat workout you ever could think of, the worst chest workout, and then head to toe, like beat down that you just, I don't know, you went skiing, you took a million falls and like you can't move the next morning.
Yeah.
That's what you feel like, you know, times 1,000 every morning, and you're cold and you're so stiff, you could barely move, and you show up and the instructor's like, get in the water or go do X, Y, and Z. That's the hardest part. And that's when many people don't know this. Most of the individuals quit the next day.
Mm-hmm.
There's not many. I should rephrase that. There are plenty that quit during an evolution. They try to like sneak out and don't let anyone see them. Most people quit the next morning. They get up and they're like, fuck this.
Yeah.
I can't even move. And the next thing you know, there's 5 or 10 helmets lined up on the grinder in front of the instructor's office with individuals that, you know, just they're done.
Mm.
So for me, if you say what's the hardest part of Buds, it was getting up out of bed every day.
Do you have to get yourself up or do they wake you up?
You know, it changes all the time. When I was there.
Like, do you ever sleep in on accident? Has that ever happened?
That never happens. Okay. Now, that definitely has happened.
Yeah.
And I'm sure individuals are going to listen to this and go, oh, this one time. And it's definitely happened. That never happened to me.
Okay.
I mean, I was scared to death.
Yeah.
Like, I would never. you know, you had your roommates. Some people slept out in town. Though there were certain parts of training, I think early on, everybody had to be in the barracks. And
sure.
Then once it loosened up a little bit, you were able to go sleep, you know, if you had an apartment or whatever. But like if you had to be there at 4:30, you were there at, you know, 4:20.
Right. So you can actually leave. You're not.
You could actually leave.
Yeah.
And again, it was in different phases.
Sure.
So there's parts of it where everybody had to be there at all times, 24/7. There are other parts you can leave and come back. I mean, there were parts where, you know, you finished at 2 a.m., you had to be back there at 4.
Yeah.
Right? So you either pass out or if you somehow stumble home or get a ride home or whatever.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. So what was the hardest part of Buds other than, I mean...
Getting up out of bed.
Yeah. Like I mean, was the physical thing, like, did you get injured at all?
No. I had some shin splints.
Yeah.
And like some... had some really like tendonitis, we'd say your ITB band,
mm-hmm.
which was very common because you're running, jogging at like this really slow pace and you're wet. And so you're really heavy. And so it puts just this extra strain on your ITB bands, which are like right outside your knees.
Yeah.
That like, you know, they come up into your hips and then they, you know, they attach to your glutes. Well, it almost feels like, you know, you're digging a knife into your knees. And so you ice them literally as much as you can. Those are the things you worry about because the pain is so excruciating. You don't know, is this a injury?
Yeah.
And the same thing with shin splints. Is this an injury? Did I break something? Did I fracture something? You know, stress fractures were rampant.
Right.
And the more people that get stress fractures, immediately you're like, do I have a stress fracture? Every time I take a step, this pain is radiating all the way up my leg and excruciating. So I had that a few times. And the instructors would just, you know, you'd run into medical for like 5 minutes. They'd literally take out a big syringe, shoot you up a Toradol, like right into the spot.
Yeah.
You know, I remember my shin one time was so big. It looked like a softball. They literally took this needle, stuck it right in there. I don't know what they put in. I think it was Toradol. Next thing you know, I'm like, yeah, I'm good to go. Let's go.
Magic juice.
Yeah, I'm back.
Nice. That's good. Yeah. So, that's funny. I'm always interested to hear the stories about that. And then the sand, right? The sand is like pretty brutal.
If I literally took my pants off right now and showed you the inside of my thighs,
yeah.
I have scars.
Yeah.
Like nasty scars from the sand rubbing constantly. My lower back, the inside of my thighs, under my arms, my lats.
Yeah.
One time it was in second phase. We were literally finished up. We were doing a 5.5 mile swim. About to move on to third phase, like almost nobody is going to be dropped after that.
Unless second phase is dive phase.
Dive
right?
phase. At that time, it was dive phase. Okay. Sorry, first phase was beat down. Second phase was dive phase. Third phase was land warfare. So we're finishing up, and I remember instructor Tori. We were on the beach. We're getting our check before we do our 5.5 mile swim, and I either made a joke or I laughed, and he did not like that. He made me fill my wetsuit up completely. Head to toe with sand before our 5.5 mile swim. And then we did the 5.5 mile swim. And when I came out of that, I was literally bleeding from everywhere. It was miserable. And because of that, I have lifelong scars. But I tried to get as much sand as I could, obviously in the water, but there's only, you know, I'm literally was swimming 5.5 miles of sandpaper between my legs. Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So I just want to go through kind of some of the Bud's questions that we've had. How was Hell Week?
Hell Week was, I mean, what I can remember from it. I was able to nap. I don't want to say often, but what I mean often for like 30 minutes a day. If I remember that right. And only because either we'd win, you know, we'd win an evolution. We'd win anytime. So I was Jolly Green boat crew. We were the big boat crew. And we got crushed on the land. It was just miserable. Our guys just couldn't, they just sucked on land. We're in the water though. We crushed everybody. We finished everything. So, you know, when we were in the water, we'd come back, we'd be light years ahead of everybody, no matter what we did. And so we'd get a little bit of rest. On the land though, we just constantly lost. So we're just constantly getting beat. So during Hell Week, it was a lot of that. Anything in the water, we were able to get a little bit of rest. Anything we did on land, we didn't get any rest.
Yeah.
The first night was pretty tough. We went, I believe it was 35 miles total on the beach. The whole night, it was like 12 hours or whatever, with either a boat on your head, a log on your shoulders, you know, in your arms, or a, you know, I think it was a light rucksack, like 35 pound rucksack, or it was the rucksack and the log, the rucksack and the boat. But we moved for literally 12 hours. It was a whole night until the sun came up. That was the start of Hell Week. So we got beat, we got beat when the sun went down, push-ups, back and forth from the water, sit-ups, leg lifts, water, all that type of stuff. And then we were told to get in our boat cruise. And then literally, I think they call it the longest mile.
Yeah.
But it was just from the Bud's compound all the way down to Imperial Beach, which is basically the border of Mexico, Tijuana. We just went back and forth all night. It was like boat on your head, log, rucksack, log, boat. And that was difficult because that was the whole night and it was tough. I mean, they basically just ran you into the ground with all this heavy shit the first night. That was like to break you in. And, you know, and then the rest of the Hell Week after that, where you basically couldn't move after that, you just stayed moving.
Yeah. Wow. So,
yeah, it was wild.
How many people quit during Hell Week? How many people were left?
We had, I'm going to screw this up. I'm going to make this number up. I'm going to say 60. So we had 175, went to 60. When we graduated, we had 23 original, 27 original. Wow. It was under 30.
And how many of those people get rolled, like medically rolled to another?
We had a ton roll.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had a lot. We had a lot of stress fractures, which I'm sure every class will tell you, but we had an enormous amount of stress fractures moving from first phase to second phase. And what happened, the instructors moved all those individuals and they didn't drop them. They just moved them to the next phase and we went on to dive phase because there were that many stress fractures.
And they have to wait for a whole new cycle.
They do because they can't, I mean, technically that stress fracture will turn into a break and like a nasty break. So you can't go on with a stress fracture because the amount of pounding you're doing is just, it's not going to hold up.
So if somebody gets rolled from dive phase, do they have to start back at the first phase?
No, they start back at dive phase.
Okay. So they just wait for the next.
Unless they did something stupid, like cheated or,
which
has happened before, and they'll make individuals go away for 2 years, come back and start over.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's wild.
So what did it feel like to get your trident?
I mean, it was it was great. I mean, it was like several years in the making. And the way they did it, I was the second class to get our tridents when we graduated from SQT or SEAL qualification training. Before that, individuals went to their teams and they were put on probation. And so they had to prove themselves to their platoons. And then they would get their trident at some point in time when the platoon thought
a blue belt in jiu-jitsu. 100%.
It was like, you can get it now or maybe we'll give it to you in 6 months.
Yeah.
And they would put them in like these little, it would literally put them in bird cages. So like your trident. Like,
so you see it.
Yeah. Yeah. It was wild. But we were the second class to get it. 235, Goggins and a few others received their Trident. I think it was the first time. They were the first class to receive it in SQT, and then we received it.
Well, you were the last Buds class before 9/11, right?
We were the Buds. I was in third phase 9/11.
Wow.
So we were the first. We were the first class to graduate.
Yeah. So you were the last.
We were the first class to graduate.
Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was wild.
So knowing that you're about to go into this, I mean, what was 9/11 like from your perspective?
From my perspective, I can't speak from others in the class, but I would say similar because we didn't know what the hell was going on.
Did you think it was a training exercise?
I thought it was a joke because I thought we were in third phase. We were almost graduated. We were shooting at one of our mountain facilities, and the instructors is, you know, early in the morning on the, you know, on the West Coast.
Yeah.
It was like, what, 5:30 or 6 a.m.? They come out from their barracks and they say, hey, planes, flew into the World Trade Center. It's crazy. And I remember us talking to each other and going, this is bullshit. They're screwing with us again. Why won't they stop screwing with us? We've been here. You know, we're about to graduate. And then they allowed us to come in and watch it on TV for like 30 seconds. And like, you're just like, whoa, this is very real. And we watched it for 30 seconds. We went right back outside and we started PT. Like it was, for us, it was nothing. There was literally no stop in training at all. But the instructors, there was this demeanor that came across that was nothing like I've ever seen before. So it went from these, you know, jovial, angry instructors, you know, never knew when they were going to flip a switch. They were drinking Red Bulls like they were water to very serious individuals that knew they were about to go to war. Yeah. We didn't understand that because we were just new students that graduated college or came from high school. We were just trying to get through this fucking hard ass training that we all signed up for. But we didn't, I don't think, realize, at least I didn't realize that we were going to quote unquote war.
Yeah.
But you can see it in the instructors, the ones that had been there for 10 or 15 or 20 years that had been waiting for this, seething, there is a demeanor that you can feel.
It's go time.
It was go time. Yeah.
Hmm. So you finish Buds and then what? I mean, did you?
You finish Buds, you go to jump school. At least that's how it was back then. Totally different now. But we went to, I think it was Georgia, Fort Benning, and jump school there. And then,
so like regular airborne school?
Yeah. Go to regular airborne school. That was fun. We, you know, try to cause as much trouble as we could and drank as hard as we could on the weekends. And then went back to California and we started SEAL qualification training, SQT. And then, you know, that was a whole training cycle for the next 6 months. We did everything. You took what you learned from Buds, like kind of the introduction to tactics, and then you advanced them in qualification training.
Yeah.
You know, and got introduced to new weapons and new tactics, and it was a lot of fun.
So how quickly from when you finished that to your first deployment?
After SQT, like it could be 2 years.
Wow.
Because then you go to a platoon, and then you work up with your platoon for a year, year and a half, 2 years. Everybody's different. Again, depends on where you go.
Yeah.
Some guys went to team two or team four. They were there for no time, and they were right out the door, deployed to Germany or wherever. And I went to SEAL team 10. They had just commissioned that team. I literally was the first group there. And so I did a full 2 year workup and it was great. And then we deployed. And then everybody in between. Some individuals, like I said, went right out the door. Others, it all depends. Some people went to their platoon and didn't make it out of their first platoon. They got shit canned right away. Yeah. So they always say at the time, the first phase officer in charge, he said, usually every class, about 7 individuals somehow sneak by and get through Buds. And so those individuals get through their platoon and then they get weeded out.
Try to find them out,
They find out there that they should not be there and they go away.
So how long did it take you to end up on SEAL Team 6? And there's a selection process for that, right?
Yeah. I think it's pretty widely known now, so I could probably talk a little bit about it.
Yeah. And
yeah, yeah, no, I keep everything as... as vanilla as I can.
Yeah, here's a question that I have. I've heard from people that, so, and you mentioned something about buds where you're like, it sucks, but it sucks with a group.
Yeah.
But I've heard that the selection process for development group is more of a solo thing. Is that right?
It's solo in terms of you are being graded and tested as an individual, for sure. You're doing things as a team because you always do things as a team in SEAL teams, right? But everything you're doing, you literally wake up every day, and if there's 45 dudes in the class, you are ranked 1 to 45. Wow. And it's right in front, and everybody sees what you're ranked, and you do that from day one until you graduate. And so it's extremely high stress. Everybody there is in, you know, best shape ever. Yeah. That's not a concern.
Yeah.
You know, I think the test to get in there is, I'm not even sure, you do like 80 push-ups straight, 15 or 20 pull-ups with a 25-pound dumbbell. Sit-ups are the same. And you have to run 5 miles in, I think, like a 7-minute pace or 7.5.
It's pretty fast.
Yeah, and then a swim. Like but you smoke all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then you go through, like, they want to know how good you are tactically. You know, can you actually shoot? Can you do CQC? Can you jump? So now it's about your skills, not how hard you are.
Yeah. Right?
Because we can take a lot of people in the world that are just tough.
Yeah.
They got the shit beat out of them when they were a kid, and they're just like, yeah, whatever. This is easy. It was like most of us.
Yeah.
But now take that individual and put a brain between their ears and make them think quickly in a high-stress environment. That's what people don't understand. And that's what also that's what individuals that haven't been there or didn't make it will say, you know, they were good enough or it didn't matter. But no, it really does matter.
Yeah.
Like when you're up there in the rafters as an instructor or watching individuals, you see what individuals that can think literally split second and shoot or not shoot and shoot and keep it like literally between the eyes and in the nose and like your kill areas and in like the center mass of your heart versus individuals that are literally pulling the trigger as fast as they can and can barely hit the paper.
Mm.
Right. And that's what, you know, that's what SEAL Team 6 is about. It's like the individuals that can think quick on their feet, that can make the shots when it counts, that cannot shoot when there's a woman holding up a phone, that can shoot between, you know, an individual that's a terrorist and a person that's a hostage and shooting the right individual. And then, you know, that's what they want to see there, right? And then also in when it comes to like the jump phase, you know, people are all over the map jumping, and they want individuals that can exit at night on oxygen with, you know, 100-something pounds of gear and be right behind the next person, have no issue, right?
Yeah.
A lot of individuals get dropped because they just can't do that, or they twist and turn and do all this other stuff.
You guys doing halo jumps?
Both halo and hey-ho. So halo, high altitude, low opening. I don't know. I don't even know what the numbers are these days, but I think 4,500 or 4,000, whatever, somebody will say that I'm wrong, for low opening. And then high opening could be anywhere from, you know, we've jumped 35,000 feet.
That's
You know, oxygen at night, right?
I've jumped from 13,000 feet, and I thought that was...
Yeah, that's wild too, right? It's so wild. I mean, I think anytime you jump out of an airplane, like even at airborne school when we were jumping at, I don't even know what they were pushing us out at, like 3,000, whatever it was. I thought that was, you know, crazy, but
yeah,
jump on oxygen when it's like negative 70 out, and when you get to the ground, you literally feel like your fingers are going to fall off. And I'm sure they have better technology now and like heated gloves and everything else, but for some reason we didn't get those messages when we were jumping back in mid-2000s or, you know, 2005, 6, 7.
35,000 feet. I mean, you're almost in space. Like, that's so crazy.
Basically in space.
Yeah. So, okay. Do you have any stories you want to tell or anything that you like to talk about that you want to get into?
I want to tell. I like to tell funny stories because, like, everybody's got war stories and they want to. Yeah, I like to tell funny stories because, you know, there's a lot of like hardcore stories, but
yeah,
know,
let's hear some funny stuff.
Who cares about that? There was one time I was running around. It was Fallujah or Ramadi. I can forget, but we're all split up, and I'm on a team of like three individuals, and we're like hopping over. Fences and walls and like running through doors and shit. And we take some contact, and I jump over a wall and I put my weapon back on the wall, and I'm looking out, like my fingers on the trigger, and I'm like trying to figure out where people are. And my buddy looks over And he goes, hey, I'm like, shut up. He goes, hey, how are you going to shoot somebody? I'm like, what are you talking about? He's like, you don't have a magazine in your weapon. He's like, where's your, he didn't say it like that. He's like, where's your fucking magazine? I'm like, oh shit. It's like, I'd been running around without a magazine. Like, obviously it like fell out somewhere, like climbing over a wall. So, you know, I would have pulled the trigger. It would have went, you know, one round.
Yeah.
So that was a funny story. And then,
you know, I've seen a lot of like police shooting breakdowns where that's happened because the adrenaline and everything.
That's all the
goes,
time. I mean, shit happens all the time. I think, you know, we used to joke and say that we weren't that good. It's just that everybody else, I feel like it's a funny story. It's a hostage rescue that I was, you know, grateful to be part of because not many individuals, very low percentage, even get to be part of a hostage rescue. But, you know, long story short, I was one of the first two in the door to rescue this American citizen. And there was the individual who was guarding him was in the room and he got up and we engaged him. But the, I was carrying an MP7 and it's a very small round, very fast round. And the selector switch was like, it was like you could barely touch it and it would move. And when you selected it, just barely, it was on semi-auto. But if you pushed it a little too hard, it passed semi-auto and went to full auto. And, you know, it was probably something we could have figured out with that prior to that. But I just remember as I put the selector switch on fire, I just was going to hit this guy three times. And when I pulled the trigger, I didn't realize, well, I realized at the time that I went all the way over to auto. And it just put out this, like, automatic burst into this guy's face. And I went, oh, shit. And we kind of laughed about it because, you know, obviously in all honesty, we rarely use auto. It's not a very accurate, right?
And is there much recoil on that?
That was like hardly any, honestly. So it didn't even matter. I mean, the group, if you looked at the groupings were maybe like 2 inch. I mean, they were so tiny at that distance. I mean, we were at barely 10 feet.
Yeah.
But it's funny because I joke with folks to say, you know, here I am trying to be the best of the best. And I don't even know what my weapon was doing at the time.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So let's fast forward to when you get out, right? 2013?
Yeah. 2013. Yeah.
And then you didn't start vets until 2017?
2017. So a couple years before then, I really started, not just me, but my wife started seeing some like really odd symptoms of like what I was going through. And like that, I think that's when I started really just, I would consider it the, you know, I'd already peaked and I don't want to call it spiraling, but you know, I was drinking hard. Nothing mattered. We were invincible, angry, didn't care about anything, completely reckless. And I had, I'd gone out to the West Coast. I needed a break. I needed to patch everything up, put my family back together. I was just kind of mentally smoked a little bit. And I had seen my first psychiatrist, and I got prescribed an antidepressant. And I was basically on antidepressants for 7 years straight. Mm. And they just didn't help. And the problem with them is about 50% of individuals that are prescribed these medications, they just don't work.
Yeah.
I mean, we were talking about this earlier. And the problem is, so we have access to. So we have access to drugs that don't work for us, except they're being prescribed to everybody. Like that's the standard. You have symptoms of TBI or PTSD or depression, anxiety, you're given antidepressant or, you know, mood stabilizer. And along with that, you know, 99% of the time you're not sleeping well and you got headaches and you can't focus and you can't remember things. And like everyone's taking the same drugs. And so you're getting drugs to sleep too. So now you're on Ambien regularly, or you're given Adderall, or you're given like Nuvigil and Provigil. And like these things like were giving me like the nastiest headaches, but I needed them so I could just function.
Yeah.
And in, I'd say between 2016 and the end of 2017, I was really struggling. And I think 2015 is when I started going to brain clinics to say, okay, maybe this is a brain thing. My wife's the one who really saw it. She saw that like cognitively, I was not there. Like I couldn't focus. I couldn't even organize my thoughts. And I feel like I was racing like 1,000 miles an hour. It's obvious my central nervous system was just not slowing down.
Yeah.
And so she's already getting me in these brain clinics. I went to 5 total. And they weren't, I don't want to say they were bad, but I wasn't healing, you know? It wasn't until I went to the Amen clinic where they actually, they did some spec scans and they saw I had like brain damage basically.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I had like, I had like Swiss cheese brain. And then I had all these biomarkers for like bipolar disorder and like all these weird things that I never, you know, no one ever told me that before.
Yeah.
But I still didn't have any true healing, right?
Right.
There was no really adjusting of my medication, or maybe there was like slightly adjusting, but I was still taking these pretty much similar drugs. I may have been adding some supplements into it, you know, fish oils and things like that reduce inflammation, but there was nothing that was healing.
Right.
You know, I was seeing a ton of, I mean, I couldn't even tell you how many psychiatrists, psychologists, therapists that I talked to in like 5 years. It was ridiculous.
And do you think all these other pills and prescriptions helped in the short term, but added a lot more problems down the road or even short term?
Yeah. I mean, I've had friends who said, yeah, I didn't touch any of those antidepressants. And the first thing I said is like, you're smart.
Yeah.
Thank God. Now those individuals still had issues.
Yeah.
But I think I probably had more issues exacerbated by the antidepressants. You know, there's weight gain, loss of libido, like all these different things, higher risk of suicide. So here they are now giving individuals who just went overseas for however many years, coming back with brain injuries, with PTSD, with depression, and they're giving them drugs or giving us drugs that have a risk of suicide. Like it just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think 100% it probably helped make me worse.
Yeah.
Right. And the thing was, I was traveling. And so if I forgot to take any of these, or if I ran out on the road, the symptoms got 10 times worse.
Yeah.
The anxiety attacks I would have from missing a pill, like let's say 2 days in a row, were unbelievable. I mean, I ended up in the emergency room thinking I was having heart attacks. And, you know, doctor's like, well, I think you're just stressed, or you're having, these are anxiety attacks. And so it was just everything.
Yeah.
And, you know, lucky for me, you know, Amber's working with a doctor, you know, and I'll talk a little bit about who these are now. For many years, we want to keep a lot of this, you know, quiet,
yeah.
But Dr. Kirk Parsley, he's out there. And so I can talk about him. He actually texted me the other day. I told him, hey, we need to catch up, but he was working in the background with Amber. He was a former SEAL, went to med school, came back and was helping folks and really helping folks with their like low testosterone, things that just the military didn't care about. So a guy would come in with like 300, their testosterone level, and barely be able to function, let alone go overseas and fight as a warrior.
Right.
And the military wouldn't do anything about that. So this, you know, Doc Parsley was really helping individuals with their sleep, with their their testosterone levels, basically just their endocrine systems. And so he was working with Amber trying to figure out how to help me. And what he had figured out was a friend of ours, a friend of his, really close friend of his, had a very similar situation, except was in over twice as long as I was, you know, did 3 times as many deployments, you know, just a stud, and he was really struggling. And he had sent this guy to go do psychedelic therapy, and the guy got better.
Mm.
And so when that guy got better, those two started working together and with Amber to say, hey, I think Marcus would benefit from this. You know, how do we figure out to get him treated?
And this was in Mexico?
Well, this was in the US right
okay,
now.
Okay,
right? Like we're just figuring this out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They approached me like in either the end of 2016, I think it was the end of 2016, about psychedelic treatment. I literally looked at Amber like she was crazy. You know, I mean, psychedelics?
Yeah.
That is crazy, right? First off, they're drugs.
Yeah.
They're legal. They're drugs.
Yeah, yeah. Those labels.
What do you mean they can help all the stuff that I had been dealing with up until that point? It just made zero sense to me at the time.
Yeah.
Just think of someone who's never done a drug before,
yeah.
Never been exposed to this stuff. And so, you know, I kept hearing a little bit more about it. And then I started researching it. And the more I researched it, the more it started to make sense that these were, yeah, they were drugs. They were drugs intended for mental health. And then it goes back even further, like thousands of years of use in different cultures. And then it made more sense. But again, I was one of those individuals, like if I didn't experience it, it was still, like the first time I drank, I think I was like 14 years old. I still didn't believe that you can drink a liquid and get a weird feeling.
Yeah.
Right. I just didn't understand it until I did it. And I'm like, oh, this is cool.
Right. oh, this is cool.
Yeah, this is cool. So that's how I felt with psychedelics. And finally, it just came to a point where Amber and I were at the lowest of the low. You know, I didn't even know who my kids were, barely, right, in the same house. She had to protect them. I was a mess. And it was almost like, hey, you got to figure something out. The brain cleanse didn't work. The antidepressants didn't work. The talk therapy obviously is not working. None of that stuff's working. So for me, this was a leap of faith. I trusted the individual that went down there. You know, we keep his name private for reasons that we just should.
Sure.
We promised him that forever, unless he says, hey, I want you to give me credit. But we'll wait until he says that. And then Dr. Kirk Parsley, who was working with him, and you know, they were able to get some money from a third person, Mikhail Vega, who had his own little nonprofit. And they just kind of worked it in the background to get me treated because these, again, these are expensive. These are $2,500, $3,500, $5,000, $15,000. I mean, these are expensive treatments. You're talking about maybe doing something one and done and change you for the rest of your, you know, rest of your life. And so I finally committed on, ironically, Veterans Day in 2017, went to this reputable retreat that had been operating for quite some time and really didn't know what I was in for, you know, and then fast forward, let's say 72 hours later, it was a life changer. I mean, it literally felt like the weight of everything that I thought I was carrying for all those years just literally cleaned up overnight. It was wild. It was so wild because part of this was a brain thing, right? Or maybe all of it was a brain thing.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say all of it. There was definitely, I definitely had a lot of mental health garbage from all the childhood stuff and then kind of all the stuff I think that, you know, we talked about earlier, some of the transition.
Sure.
Some of the stuff I think that I dealt with in the military. And then, like I said, it all comes to a head when it all kind of hits. It's not one thing. You may have a little bit here, a little bit there, but when you put it all together, it just is like a nuclear bomb. It just kind of all went away almost immediately, which is crazy to even think about people listening to this right now. But that's how fast many of these psychedelics work.
Right.
And I just want to say right now, like, shouldn't be doing these illegally. The amount of prep and integration, like before and after, should be done correctly. You know, I feel these should be regulated. And I mean, I'm scared to death of psychedelics. You know, there's a lot of people talk about microdosing, this and that, and I have dabbled with a little bit of everything. But these are so powerful that we got to be very careful. They literally do a 180 from someone's life.
Yeah,
like you don't even recognize some people after because they are so changed in a good way.
Yeah.
Right. In a good way. And so think about what can happen. Like these can open up serious floodgates of trauma, thoughts and instances and experiences in your life that you may have like buried in your subconscious,
blacked out.
Totally forgot about it, siloed it, but it's affecting you every day. And those floodgates open when you're on these medicines.
Yeah.
And so if you're not prepared to handle the sexual abuse, your buddy getting killed, your mom or dad dying, your worst incident ever, you know, all those things that are affecting you, they could all flood open at one time. And if you're not ready to deal with them, that's when people get in trouble.
Right.
That's when individuals struggle really bad. And so for me, I opened up the floodgates that evening. My therapist, she's a Tibetan Buddhist philosopher, and she's been working with Ibogaine for 20 years. She slept at the foot of my bed on the floor, and she had been working with this medicine literally for 20 years with addicts, with individuals with PTSD and brain injury. And she said, Marcus, in 20 years of working with this and working with individuals, she goes, I have never seen anyone throw up and have as much struggle as you have.
Yeah.
And I kind of laughed. I said, well, I think I do I take that as like a badge of honor? Like, did I win?
Yeah.
Did I win this competition? Or I'm always like, you know, look at this competitive nature.
I didn't fail, right?
I didn't fail, right? Like, I was like, hey, did I do well? You know, did I do good? I mean, I literally was, but it really did purge so many different things and just like woke me up. And I just couldn't wait to see Amber and hug her and say sorry and say, like, I get it. It just lifted everything off of me. And it just put me on a path of healing. And so that was in 2017. 2018, 19, I had way more ups than I did downs. The downs, you were able to climb out of a lot easier because you were able to like bounce back from the incident that, you know, the experience that you went through. And nothing happens, I shouldn't say nothing, because many individuals, it's a one and done. For me, I had to do more work. But for me, that first time was literally cleaning out the filter and the carburetor, you know?
So do you remember it pretty well?
I remember it being really dark, really evil, really bloody, really demonic. You know, it scares people when I talk about it like that, because some people are like, oh, I had the best blissful experience. And I'm like, well, F you.
Yeah.
Now I'm not going to lie. The last two times I did Ibogaine, they were actually blissful. They were peaceful. There were some intense moments, but I was able to handle it and deal with it. And it was more for me learning and growth and polishing versus the first time where it was like, hey, we are going to work through some shit and we're going to get you better.
Yeah.
Right. And the stuff I remember, it was just dark and black and bloody. And it was just very miserable experience. Yeah. For me.
Question.
Yeah.
When you were growing up, you said your parents were hippies, so I assume you didn't grow up in like a religious household.
No, even though I had a Jewish mom, Catholic dad.
And you went to Catholic school?
I went to Catholic high school. You know, I was like a Jewish kid that went to Catholic high school.
So
I definitely got...
New York, baby.
I took a lot of shit from that.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I was the, you know, quote unquote Jew boy. Right?
Yeah.
Like, and I got a lot of fights for that. I never was raised with a religion.
Did you believe in God? A God?
I didn't even know what that meant.
Right.
Right. I didn't know what that meant. I would go to Easter Mass or Midnight Mass and that was it. But there was no, and I think my dad turned his back on religion. My dad was sent away at 4 years old to the Bronx, all boys Catholic school. Like,
yeah,
you know, and we're like looking back, you can kind of see what went on there.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to 100% like, I know what went on there because I know my dad.
Yeah.
And those kids were absolutely, they were abused.
Yeah.
They were absolutely abused. And so I think he turned his back on the church.
Yeah.
And they just didn't raise me with anything, even though my dad would go to work. My mom would like bust out the menorah and dreidel and like we'd celebrate like Hanukkah.
Yeah.
And then she like put it all away when he came home because she was scared to death.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was just like weird. Like that's how I grew up. It was just like this weird.
I had a similar thing. Yeah. So did you through this experience feel like you connected with?
Oh, like unbelievably. Because after 2 days, so I also did Ibogaine, and there's different protocols. A couple years ago, I did a 5-MeO DMT experience, which is a very short. So two of the toughest psychedelics out there, 5-MeO DMT, not regular DMT, but 5-MeO, different molecule, and then Ibogaine.
Do you smoke it?
The 5-MeO you do now.
Okay.
However, when it becomes medicalized, right now it's in phase 2 clinical trials spray, a nasal spray.
Okay.
IV, there's a sublingual, like, you ever have like a mint you put on your tongue and it,
yeah, you put it under your tongue.
Yeah. I think a Thai is developing that. So in a couple years, we'll have access to it in a medical setting through one of those. Right now it's fucking smoked,
right,
you know?
Right.
And, it gets you from 0 to 1,000 in like 5 seconds, 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And it is the most spiritual, enlightening experience that you could ever, it's impossible to explain. It's perfect. It's unconditional love.
Yep.
You sit with the creator. I mean, you see the universe literally form. It's, you know, this sounds crazy, and individuals who don't understand, it is definitely crazy. Because trust me, like, I still think it's crazy talking about it.
Yeah.
But until you experience it.
I had I would call a near-death experience that changed my whole perspective. And I didn't do DMT, but it felt very much like the stories that I've heard of DMT, where you're being flung through this tunnel. And anyways, I understand. When people say, you don't understand unless you understand. Like, I get it.
You get it.
I get it.
So Amber does a good job at this. You don't need psychedelics to have this experience, right? Yeah. That's where, you know, Jesus and Buddha and they've had these. Now we don't know if they had experiences with psychedelics, right? There's a theory out there, right? But you don't need it, right? Like, she has had experiences just through, like, just God just speaking through her.
Yep.
And others have had near-death experiences. Others have done it through plant medicines, right? Like I have.
Yep.
And so there's many ways that people can get there, can reach that place where you know that we're not alone.
Yeah.
Right? And we don't know if it's a white, you know, male with a beard sitting on a throne, right? Like, that's kind of,
it's just love.
It's just unconditional love. Yeah. It's a spirit. It's a power that you can't explain, right?
The only way that I can describe it from my perspective and my experience is it's everything that we chase in life. Like, all the things that we're looking for, the reason why people do drugs, the reason why people chase sex or love or friendship or companion, it's that home feeling that we're missing. That's how I would describe it. But
it's, you realize that we're just in this, like, human flesh. I remember jumping up in the, like, right at the end when I came back, wherever I went, and just, like, pulling my skin and, like, laughing, crying about it, going, like, we're just, like, this flesh of, like, this is so temporary.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, man, human, we ruin everything. You know, I saw nuclear explosions, right? I saw that because we're destroying ourselves, right? And I saw all this in my experience for whatever reason.
Yeah.
Right? Like, for whatever reason, I don't know the reason. The reason I was able to shoot off there is because it felt like an eternity. I started asking all these questions, like, as soon as I took the hit. Like, why are we here? What is God? Why am I here? What's my purpose? Why should? And then all of a sudden, like, I kept asking these questions. So, like, it was going through, like, these crazy.
Yeah.
And then I just went, wait a minute. Stop asking why. And I got, like, as soon as I said stop asking why, that was, like, my let go.
Yeah.
I literally got immediately catapulted to infinity and beyond. And then I learned, I saw everything, that this is just temporary.
Yeah.
And that there's a much higher power and purpose for all of us. And that, you know, it is all about love, right?
Yeah.
It's unconditional love. And we just have ruined everything, like the flesh and bone.
Yeah.
You know, and then I came back and it all made sense. And from that day on, I'm just like, whatever.
Did you experience peace before this?
Never. No. The only time I felt peace was my Ibogaine experience. I was that morning I woke up. I've never experienced peace. I've always wanted peace. I've had this, like, you know, I've talked about it on, you know, on Sean Ryan, that all I was searching for is peace. If I can just be at peace, everything else is fine. Like, there doesn't matter. And that's what I felt like after Ibogaine and then my 5-MeO experience. It was just like, that's it. Like, I'm good. No matter what happens, we're good. Now, I still have, like, a competitive nature. And I think that is just, like, maybe part of me, but it's like the best part of me is, like, I just get it.
Yeah.
You know? And I can always go back to that place if I try to push too hard.
Right.
You know, like, oh, it really doesn't matter. Oh, it's just going to be fine.
Right.
You know, it'll be fine. Because I know that. I've seen it. It'll be fine.
The first thing I noticed when I met you was there's a piece about you, which you don't always see. You know, I mean, I've had a good amount of military people that have been on the podcast, and I feel like peace is missing with a lot of people in general. But the first thing I noticed about you was like, there's this, I can't even describe it, but there's a peace. And I'm wondering how much of that came from these experiences.
All of it. I mean, it all came from the experiences, but I've had to work at it too. So these experiences have allowed me to experience peace,
yeah,
and feel what peace is like. And then life creeps back in slowly, but then you could always see it. That's where you're never not aware anymore. Like, you are so aware. You can read people. I wish I had this while I was in the military and dealing with folks. And I could read everybody now. I can tell within the first 30 seconds, like, oh, that person had some shit go on in their life or not. Or it's, and so when peace does not, when I should say not when peace, but when life starts to creep back in, I could immediately feel it and see it. And then I can just kind of come back into like my groundedness, right? Through meditation, through breath work, you know, cold tubs, whatever I need to do, I can come back.
So when you say you see that in people, is it through empathy? Like, do you see it from their point of view? Like, I can understand why people are this way.
I absolutely do. Unless their ego is just too much and they're at a point where they're almost putting me down in a way. I don't like that. You know, don't put me down. Don't put my family, my friends. But if they're just acting in a certain way, I could see that and go, you know, it's them, obviously, and they can work on some things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, we are running out of time. There's so much more that I wanted to get into.
Yeah, there's a lot.
I know.
I kind of, that's the problem. I can talk for a while.
No.
I love talking about this stuff.
This is, we're completely unfiltered. We don't do any of the, we got to have you back for round two at some point.
Yeah.
I hope we can get that scheduled.
I'm right over the bridge, so we should come back for round two.
Yeah. Marcus, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
Can you leave our audience with one last positive message?
Yeah, I think we are all struggling regularly with what's tomorrow going to be like. And, you know, am I going to have enough money? Is my family going to be okay? Where am I going to end up? You're going to be fine. You got to remember that people will be fine. Trust, you know, use your gut regularly. You know, kind of Amber's taught me when the head, the heart, head, heart, what's the third part? Head, heart, and gut kind of all sync, you know, it's the right answer. So sometimes we're trying to use our head to make decisions, or maybe just our heart, or, you know, I have this feeling in my gut. But when you can put all three of those together, the decision is right. And so if you can trust like your intuition and your yourself more, like, we know what the right answers are. That's the other thing. We're always looking for what other people want to hear. We know what the right answers are. If you can follow what you believe is correct, you're always going to win. And now we're saying, like, go do bad things if that's what you, but we're saying, if you can follow what you believe in your heart, in your head, in your stomach, what makes you feel right, that is right, right? And it really doesn't matter what other people think after that. When people, I respect so much individuals now than kind of groupthink. Where before, I joke, I was a good soldier. You know, I just wanted to fit in. I want everybody to like me. Now, I try to color outside the lines as far as I can.
Yeah.
Because I think those are the individuals that I want to, that I respect.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I think we saw a lot of that during COVID, a lot of individualism and a lot of groupthink.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Crazy. Exactly.
Next time, we'll get into it.
I can't wait.
Thank you so much.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Cool.
Thank you.
Yeah.